Vancouver Institute. Let me initially draw your attention to the remaining lectures this term. The last half of our autumn series promises to be no less distinguished than the very successful lectures which we have already heard. Next week, on November the 7th, Dr. Martin Hoffman of the Faculty of Medicine at this university will speak on Understanding Diabetes, What Everyone Should Know. On November the 14th, Professor John Crispo of the University of Toronto, but temporarily visiting at Simon Fraser University, will speak to us on Industrial Relations Mandate for Canada. On November 21st, we were to have, as you know, Professor Czesław Milos, the Polish Nobel laureate, but he regrettably was unable to meet that commitment, and accordingly we hope to have him the next year, not this winter, but the following year for the Vancouver Institute. However, we have a most interesting and exciting replacement, we feel, in Professor Charles F. Doran, the director of the Center of Canadian Studies at Johns Hopkins, who will speak to us on November 21st on Canadian-American relations under the Reagan administration. And then on November 28th, our last lecture for this term, Professor Thomas K. Shoyama, former civil servant, deputy minister, and now at the School of Public Administration, University of Victoria, will speak on Canada's economy, prospect, and policy. I would like, with your permission, to take a minute or two of your time to address myself to that dwindling minority of members of the audience who have neglected or forgotten to take out membership in the Vancouver Institute. Our fees remain, as always, insignificant. $2 for a student, $10 single, $15 for a family. For this, you get approximately 20 Saturday evenings of intellectual pleasure and stimulation. My own recognition of the bargain value of Institute membership was recently reinforced when my wife purchased two tickets for the Peking Opera, which cost only slightly less than 3 years of family membership to the Vancouver Institute, or over 60 lectures for two or more family members. Perhaps, I sometimes wonder, the fatal flaw in our fee structure may be that our rates are so low that they deprive you of that opportunity for conspicuous consumption which comes from paying through the nose. At the moment, I prefer to treat this as a hypothesis, one which I hope you will disprove by patiently queuing to join the Institute after tonight's lecture. All members of the Institute, including those on whose membership cards the ink has not yet dried, are invited to a reception honoring tonight's speaker in the UBC Faculty Club. This reception is being graciously hosted by Dr. and Mrs. Dennis Chitty, Mr. and Mrs. Arthur J.F. Johnson, Dr. and Mrs. Joseph Cates, and Mrs. Sherwood Lett. I hope this prospect of almost instant gratification for those wavering between joining and not joining will tip many of you into the ranks of members of the Institute. Now, tonight it gives me an extra and special pleasure to introduce as our guest speaker not only a distinguished academic, but a UBC colleague and friend of many years standing. Dr. Markéta Getz-Stankiewicz was born in Czechoslovakia and received her BA, MA, and PhD from the University of Toronto. She did her PhD under the supervision of that eminent scholar, Dr. Barker Fairley. Dr. Getz-Stankiewicz joined UBC in 1957 and in subsequent years has advanced from lecturer to full professor. Recently, she was appointed head of the Department of Germanic Studies. In addition to her important administrative contributions to UBC as department head, our speaker for tonight has a most impressive teaching record, including the Certificate of Merit for Outstanding Teaching in 1973. Although she is head of the Department of Germanic Studies, Dr. Getz-Stankiewicz has specialized for many years in the study of Czech theater. The Czech theater is unique in that although the number of Czech speakers in the entire world is only one-half to two-thirds the population of Canada, the products of that theater are of international caliber. A second and regrettable quality, and unfortunately not unique to Czechoslovakia, is that Czech playwrights cannot have their plays performed in their own country. Hence the anomalous fact that when Czech plays are performed, they are performed before foreign audiences and in translation. It is this aspect of the Czech theater which is the subject of our speaker's recent brilliant book issued by the University of Toronto Press under the evocative title, The Silenced Theater, Czech Playwrights Without a Stage, 1958 to 1978. With this background, our speaker tonight is well prepared to address us on the subject, the Czech theater. While we straighten out a little of the technology, perhaps the people at the back might like to come down and sit at the front.
Does this work? Thank you very much, Alan. You gave me such a bad conscience with your initial remarks that I think I will be the first one to queue up afterwards to join the Vancouver Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, when preparing these remarks, I was wondering what I could presume you would know about Czech culture, and who of you would mentally place the small, elongated country geographically where it really belongs, smack in the middle of Europe. Not in Eastern Europe. This geopolitical or politico-geographic term completely misrepresents reality and geography. And I felt that some of you might perhaps, when they hear the word Czechoslovakia, they might think of beautiful lead crystal, or perhaps of Dvořák's cello concerto, or still others might think of real Pilsner beer, which is called Plzeňské in Czechoslovakia. And an occasional one among you, perhaps, of the 100 glistening spires that reach for the sky when you stand by the castle Hradčany in Prague and overlook the old city across the river Vltava. But then, why indulge in fleeting impressions if we have on the front cover of Books in Canada, October 1981, a Czech author who is also a Canadian, Joseph Skvoretsky. Some of you may have seen the cover and have read the article on him. He won the prestigious Literary Neustadt Prize, and he, to my mind, will go down in the annals of literary history as a Czech writer who became a Canadian writer and who cast a sort of rainbow bridge across the Atlantic and merged the tortured and yet somehow serenely ironic Middle European consciousness with Canadian honesty, sincerity, and innocence. But for those who perhaps have not a clear idea of what this merger means, I would like to approach the matter in a way sanctioned by time and usage, a short true story. It is the true story of a gentleman sitting there in the upper left corner somewhere, a businessman who is now retired, a Vancouverite, who lives on Granville Street. Having grown up in the West End during the early part of this century, and the West End was an even more exciting time, place then, I'm told, than today, he moved with his parents to Granville, a little bit further south, in the early 1920s. In 1935, perhaps, he bought himself a small house at Granville and 54th. And by the time his children reached maturity, he moved down to a bigger house at Granville and Angus. Then when he retired in about 1975, he was sick of mowing the lawn and moved into an apartment at Granville and 16th. Well, you will say, is there anything significant about a life lived on Granville Street? And I have to say, not much. But there is another gentleman who sits over there somewhere at the back, to the right, who protests. It is a gentleman who has come over from Prague to visit his daughter, who came out in 1968. He hasn't seen her for 13 years. And he has about the same disposition as the gentleman on the left. He's kindly and quiet, peace-loving, and likes dogs and has a stamp collection, but he has lived a very different life. I may add that he finally got permission for a visit to Canada, because financed by his daughter, of course, because he no longer, as a retired man, he no longer belongs to the workforce of a people's democracy. Now, why does he protest about our saying, or my saying, that to live a life on Granville Street is not very significant? He protests because he feels it is extremely significant to spend your life on a street which never changes its name. And as we solid Vancouverites raise our eyebrows at such a suspect assessment of value, we hear his story. Our visitor from Prague also lived on the same street all his life, in fact, in one and the same house, number 144. Yet he changed his address no less than 7 times. When he was born, he lived at 144 Kaiser Franz Josef Straße for the Austrian Emperor. In 1918, it became Masaryk Street for the first president of the Czechoslovak Republic. In 1939, 21 years later, when Hitler occupied Czechoslovakia, it became Hermann Göring Straße. And in 1945, at the end of World War II, it became Eduard Benes Street for President Benes, who had just returned from exile in Britain. In 1948, a mere 3 years later, it was renamed Stalin Street, and 10 years later, in 1958, when the personality cult became discredited, it became the Street of Soviet Friendship. During the years of political thaw that preceded the Prague Spring, it was renamed, because then one began to read literature, world literature, so it was renamed enthusiastically Ernest Hemingway Street. But this didn't last long. Immediately after August 1968, when, as you will remember, Soviet troops occupied Czechoslovakia, it became the Street of the Red Army. That is what it is still called. This, the fate of living on such a street, with all that goes with it, and that is plenty, as you will be able to imagine, is quite typical of the fate of a member of this small nation, 15 million, that has been living at the center of Europe for more than 1,000 years, in the ancient kingdom of Bohemia, which, on 17th century maps, when Europe was still drawn in the shape of a beautiful regal woman, Bohemia was then represented as a large jewel in the lady's belt. I would have put it on but I didn't have it as a slide, otherwise I would have shown it to you. It's a beautiful map, 1610. To live in a surrounding which keeps changing its nature even within a man's lifetime has a strange effect on people. They need to somehow anchor themselves within themselves and to feel that they are rooted while political storms of all kinds sweep over the roofs of their houses, more often than not, however, crashing into their very private spheres, into their kitchens and their bedrooms, and wreaking havoc. The most characteristic mark of Czech culture is that it is ancient and young at the same time. It has a long memory as a nation, but throughout history it has constantly been threatened by dissolution and extinction, by loss of self. The fact that this self was not lost, but reemerged strongly and distinctly in the 19th century, was not due to political moves or winning wars. I don't think Czechoslovakia has ever won any war. It is due to something that an English-speaking nation would scarcely count among the weapons or tools for survival, namely its language. It was during the 19th century the Czech intellectuals were faced with the giant question whether to make the effort to preserve the Czech language, to hammer out a new Czech literature. It would have been much easier to give in to the surrounding German culture. If you look at the map, there were the German dukedoms in the north and Austria in the south. But the Czech writers chose to undergo the vast intellectual effort of remolding their own language. Survival as a choice to speak and write and read is implicit, would be regarded as a sort of, or could be regarded as a sort of motto for the Czech nation. For them, the Descartesian dictum has the variation, I speak, therefore I am. It is in this spirit that we should look at Czech literature. It's not much of an exaggeration to say that the best Czech authors have mostly been forbidden at home. I cannot go back into history, we don't have the time for it, but take the last 40 years. Karel Čapek was banned under National Socialism. Today he is available, but in expurgated versions. And he is not sufficiently known in the West. I think it's one of the giants of 20th century literature. Kafka, who is a very Czech author, although he wrote in German, is also persona non grata in Czechoslovakia, although in the early 60s there was a big Kafka conference and hundreds of scholars from throughout the world met there to discuss this mysterious and fascinating figure. The nation's best writers today, Havel, Kohout, Klima, Topol, Vaculík, Kundera, you may know one or two of them, are treated as if they did not exist. Their books are not found in bookstores or libraries. Their plays are not performed on stage. Don't forget that Prague has 30 theaters that are crammed full and play every evening, 7 days a week. Their names are not found in histories of literature or in critical works. Indeed, they aren't even in the telephone book because none of these writers is allowed to have a telephone. In other words, the system pretends that these people do not exist. I'll say something more about that later. The brief period of liberalization of Czech literature during the 1960s has become somehow symbolic for the West. The Prague Spring, with its notion of brevity built into the very concept, spring always comes and goes very quickly, is known all over the Western world as a period of bursting creativeness, and the number of significant works of literature written during the years preceding that spring is truly amazing. It was a creative renaissance in the real sense of the word. This, however, was more than 13 years ago, And as you know, the occupation of August 1968 only took a few hours, but the tightening of the ideological grip was slow and steady. Works, literary works, dramas that were still performed in 1969 have been blacklisted since and do not exist. Contemporary Czech literature, insofar as it has literary value, has not been printing for been printed for 13 years, unless you discount what is being printed abroad. And Škvorecký, the writer about whom I spoke in the beginning, also has a publishing house and prints the writers, all. Most great contemporary Czech literature. So it is very interesting that what is being written in Czechoslovakia today is being printed in Canada and distributed from Canada across the whole world. Now, the situation is such, I can't go into details, but 200 Czech and Slovak writers have been proscribed. And you know what it means if such a small nation, if you have 200 writers who are forbidden to publish, you can imagine that this is indeed the majority. Several of them have been imprisoned. For example, 145 historians have been dismissed from their posts, and history has been and is being rewritten. The nation is slowly deprived of the language of its best minds and the memory of its past. And if you lose your language and your memory, you somehow lose yourself. And it is this process of organized forgetting which Milan Kundera's new book, The Book of Laughter and Forgetting, which made the bestseller list in the United States, that's what this book is about. When a big power wants to deprive a small country of its national consciousness, it uses the method of organized forgetting. Already, a young man who is 20 today has not seen, let's say, the memorandum by Václav Havel, which has been translated into 14 languages and has been performed from Stockholm to Paris to Israel to Toronto. The young man has not seen Ivan Klima's Games, which had a very successful run in Vancouver last summer. It was performed by the Touchstone Theatre. And the young man has not seen, let's say, Pavel Kohout's Poor Murderer, which won acclaim on Broadway. The fact that the IPA, the International Publishers Association, conference in Stockholm last summer dedicated its plenary session to discussing the freedom to publish, and they took Czech and Slovak the Czech and Slovak literary scene as an example of oppression, but this had no results. The crust of literary dictatorship is hard, and yet, and here perhaps I come to the brighter side of my remarks, remarkable things go on underneath that crust. The underground edition, Edice Petlice, sort of padlock edition, has now over 200 titles. The works are typewritten by loyal hands and circulate in bound copies on onion skin paper. They are very hard to read, and people usually get one night. They have to read them in one night in order to pass them on, because they have to be typed, because Xerox machines are guarded by the regime more zealously than military installations. Each work reaches in such a way a few hundred readers, among whom we can only hope, is also our hypothetical young man who was deprived of the best works of his own culture. What I would now like to do for a brief time is to give you a little guided tour through what seemed to me the main concerns of Czech literature. I will give you three keywords or signpost words, concepts if you like, of which the stuff of the Czech theatre and Czech literature on the whole is made. There is truth, philosophically in essence, perhaps describable as a man's right to recognize what is real. There is language, communicative in essence, a man's ability to give shape to his thought in words. And there is humor, an attitude, a sense of proportion, the ability to distinguish games from reality, the ability to laugh, and thus preserve some measure of inner freedom. These three concepts perhaps separate us above all from the animal world. An animal neither strives for the revelation of truth, nor can it formulate thoughts in words, nor can it laugh about the discrepancies of life and thus rise above them. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a great animal lover. I also know that dogs can talk and that porpoises have a sense of humor. But still, it is these three aspects of man's nature, those that render him truly human, which are most dangerous to a totalitarian system of government. This is why writers, peaceable men, who wouldn't harm a fly and who simply seek to express questions and seek to figure out what life is all about, that they are considered subversive, dangerous, enemies of the people. In my very crude little guided tour, let me take language first. In English, we have a magnificent classic, of course, a man who as early as 1948 recognized the power of language over thought and formulated it with penetrating clarity. It is, of course, George Orwell. In the appendix to 1984, and we are almost there, aren't we, at that date, he formulates the principles of newspeak, the language conceived by state authorities which would express the values of the new society. Let me read you a little. The principles of newspeak. Newspeak was the official language of Oceania and had been devised to meet the ideological needs of Ingsoc, the new society. And then Orwell goes to telling you there is the vocabulary A, vocabulary B, vocabulary C, which I won't repeat. But then he summarizes. From the foregoing account, it will be seen that in newspeak, the expression of unorthodox opinions above a very low level was practically impossible. It was, of course, possible to utter heresies of a very crude kind, a species of blasphemy. It would have been possible, for example, to say, "Big Brother is ungood." But this statement, which to an orthodox ear merely conveys a self-evident absurdity, could not have been sustained by reasoned argument because the necessary words were not available. Later, when old speak had been once for all superseded, the last link with the past would have been severed. History had already been rewritten, but fragments of the literature of the past survived here and there, imperfectly censored, and so long as one retained one's knowledge of old speak, it was possible to read them. In the future, such fragments, even if they chanced to survive, would be unintelligible and untranslatable. And later, in practice, this meant that no book written before approximately 1960 could be translated as a whole. Pre-revolutionary literature could only be subjected to ideological translation, that is, alteration in sense as well as language. Take, for example, the well-known passage from the Declaration of Independence. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It would have been quite impossible to render this into newspeak while keeping to the sense of the original. The nearest one could come to doing so would be to swallow the whole passage up in a single word, crime think. These passages, Orwell's passages, by now as old as the post-war Czechoslovak Republic, could serve perfectly as a model for the official normalization of language in Central Eastern Europe today. These nations' struggle for survival today is largely, odd as it may seem, a struggle for a free language. For example, the Polish writer Andrzej Luczaj speaks of the dictatorship of language in contemporary totalitarian systems, and the revolt against the monopoly of certain words is at the time a war against totalitarianism. He speaks, Luczaj that is, of the war for language, which is essentially a struggle for intellectual and political independence. Examples illustrating this abound in Czech theater and prose. Again and again, writers explore ways in which language can be used to disorient and confuse. The best example, a classic by now, and if some of you know it, I apologize for a repetition, is surely Václav Havel's The Memorandum. The scene, 1965 it was written. The scene is an office, clean, impersonal, with desks and papers, fire extinguishers, a secretary, coffee cups, pens, etc. A mild-mannered office manager, Joseph Gross, arrives at his office one morning and finds on his desk an official memorandum of the kind he had found 1,000 times before. Only this one is different. It is written in an incomprehensible language. Gross is stunned. The next thing is that he finds out that without his knowledge, a new language, Ptidepe, has taken over. Employers are getting A+ in Ptidepe lessons. Gross's deputy manager breaks into Ptidepe, which he fluently commands, at the drop of a hat. Gross tries to adapt himself to the new order. He takes Ptidepe lessons, but promptly gets an F for failed. Gradually, he slides from one demotion to another, a grotesque version of the outsider, the alienated man, the monster who can't speak other people's language, who can't make sense to other people and can't make sense of what other people say. Now, I will give you a little taste of that. Ptidepe teacher is called Lea. If anybody speaks Czech, in Czech it's Peřina, which is perhaps even more. Peřina would be, the direct translation of Peřina would be the feather bed, feather cover, down cover. The Ptidepe teacher. Ptidepe, as you know, ladies and gentlemen, is a synthetic language, built on strictly scientific basis. Its grammar is constructed with maximum rationality. Its vocabulary is unusually broad. It is a thoroughly exact language, capable of expressing with far greater precision than any current natural tongue all the minutest nuances in the formulation of important office documents. The result of this precision is, of course, the exceptional complexity and difficulty of Ptidepe. There are many months of intensive study ahead of you, ladies and gentlemen, which can be crowned by success only if they are accompanied by diligence, perseverance, discipline, talent, and a good memory. And, of course, by faith. Without a steadfast faith in Ptidepe, nobody yet has been able to master it. Later on, you all know that in a natural language, it is often enough to exchange one letter for another. Goat, boat. Love, dove. Or simply remove one letter and you create confusion. Fox, ox. And the whole meaning of the word is thus changed. And then there are all the homonyms. Consider what terrible mischief can be caused in an inter-office communication when two words with entirely different meanings are spelled exactly the same way. For example, P-O-S-S-U-M, possum. The first designating an American small arboreal or aquatic nocturnal marsupial mammal with thumbed hind foot. The second, the Latin equivalent of I am able. Such a confusion is unthinkable if you use Ptidepe. Now, you see, the Czech audience, when they hear this and they heard this on stage for 2 years, it was written in 1965, it got on stage in 1966, and between 66 and 68, they heard this on stage. And the audience is, of course, extremely responsive, gets excited, stamps their feet, claps, roars with laughter, because they recognize real life in it. Now, I'll just give you another little example here. When Gross speaks to his deputy, the deputy, whose name is Savant, or Savant, the names have been changed from the Czech, not to cause too many difficulties, because Czech is difficult to pronounce. I will just call him the deputy. The deputy says, it's like this, you see, Mr. Gross. Although I have been employed by this organization, I am no common staff member. I am, as you well know, a scholar of the new sort, and of course I know everything about Ptidepe, and I doubt that you do. As such, I naturally take certain, exceptions to some of the rather bureaucratic procedures of my staff colleagues. As a matter of fact, it's not really exceptions I take. It's more like objections. No, objections isn't the right word either. How shall I put it? I'm sorry, you see, I'm used to speaking in Ptidepe, and so it is rather difficult for me to find the right word in a natural language. Gross, please go on. The deputy. In Ptidepe, one would say, Aksayores. My colleagues sometimes allude Cabos Padiel too much, and at the same time they keep forgetting that Astrochaizenic Alfek Algidos, and the secretary of the deputy. Abdi has fired Godot Nim Orca, deputy. Kafai Hafiz Okubi Rizal, the secretary. Rizal, Barubado de Rizal, Kabisach, Mahok, Haibam. Gross, I beg your pardon. The deputy, hutput, which means quite exact. Gross, I understand. Yes, I'm completely hutput about it. The trick of this play is, of course, that Havel actually invented the language, this nonsensical language, which was spoken on stage. And in a society which is used to having sacred, unalterable texts quoted to them at school, at office, everywhere, from the age of this high, they, of course, recognize they react to it with a recognition which is beyond our comprehension. Although I must confess, when I got myself, when I got a memorandum the other day, I had a feeling like Mr. Gross, because it came through from a college and it concerned a supervisory training program, and I was asked whether I wouldn't take a course on the importance of interpreting nonverbal cues in interpersonal communication and whether I wanted to have some information on the principles of activity payoffs. And it was also felt that I definitely should learn some about the sources and consequences of role conflict ambiguity. I didn't make this up. Now, another example, this time from Ivan Klimas, A Bridegroom for Marcella, will show us a more brutal form of using language as a power tool. The play moves around the themes of guilt, free will, and oppression. A quiet clerk, Mr. Clement, has been asked to present himself at a governmental office because he is told he apparently wants to marry Miss Marcella Lukashova, who lives in the same apartment block as he. Clement is stunned. His connection with the girl is limited to having helped her once with the groceries. Far from having any amorous designs on her, he has his own girlfriend whom he is very fond of and whom he wants to marry. The rest of the play consists in Clement being questioned and molded by three officials with methods varying from moralizing rhetorics about conscience and love to the occasional blow on the head, which, however, is much less important than the language they use. And I just give you a tiny example. Clement, why did you pick me up? How did you find me? Why are you torturing me? He says we are torturing him. He said that we are torturing him, the official. Clement, I don't love her, the official. He is sorry for himself. Chin up, be a man. Clement, I have never loved her. Why do you talk about her constantly, Marcella? Do you want to tell us what we are supposed to talk about? He doesn't even want to talk to us. He doesn't even want to have a conversation with us. This is too much, even for me. See, they revert the thrust of the argument into another direction and use his own argument in order to come back to their own. I don't know whether I have time for another bit. The official, you have no conscience, Mr. Clement. I thought when you came in here that you have a conscience, that you have conscience and feeling, Mr. Clement. It is terrible, Mr. Clement, when other people have to take over your conscience, when the officials have to take over your conscience. Well, if everybody were like you, one couldn't even continue living if people started to finish each other off. Sorry, I'm not very good there because I'm translating it as I'm reading it. One more example from Havel, namely from his play The Mountain Hotel, which was written in 1976. If the other two examples I gave you were meant to illustrate language as a tool for alienation on the one and power on the other hand, this example shows language having become mechanized, a system of repeated signs and signals unrelated to people's real feelings and concerns. The setting of the play is a mountain resort where a number of people converse about things one usually talks about on a holiday: food, love, trips, reminiscences, tea in a thermos, sex, the weather. Havel treats the subject as if he had fed a number of topics, gestures, actions into a computer and let the computer arrange them symmetrically. The result is a seemingly normal five-act play, but it is the comments, phrases, and gestures which have become autonomous, and the characters have become interchangeable. In each act, for example, someone else reminisces about Paris with the same words. So there is a memory of Paris. The memory is there, but every time it is expressed by a different person. The person, the talker, becomes interchangeable. The phrase, the phrase has become the actor in the sense of the acting one. One lady, for example, one lady, she spends her time knitting on stage, and whenever she goes off stage, we know that she distributes precisely portioned out embraces in her hotel room. So that we know the lovemaking exists in the hotel room, but the partners do not matter. They are exchangeable. In the West, we call this way of expressing the mechanization of language and action disintegration of personality, and we make much of it in contemporary literature. You have Pinter, you have Pynchon, you have Malamud, and so on. Just as we talk much about alienation and breakdown in communication. But it is startling that for the most consequential artistic expression of this linguistic malaise, truth, and or the search for truth. How does one find it? How does one recognize it? How does one write about it and let people know, I'm now trying to write something about the search for truth? When do we know what is good and true, if truth is goodness, as Plato tells us? When have we reached the limits of the rational? The topic is no stranger to Western literature, and some of you perhaps remember a bestseller of the 1960s, Catch-22, when the hero, Joseph Heller is the author, when the hero of Catch-22 is never quite sure what is real and what is unreal, or what is sane and what is crazy. If you remember, he says, he's in the war and he's supposed to fly off on a mission in a plane, and he says, if I let them know that I've got my brains, my wits about me, that I'm sane, then they'll send me up on that mission and I'll get shot down, then I'm really crazy. If I'm crazy or I pretend I'm crazy, then I won't be sent off and then I'm really sane. And this is the catch-22. Colorful variations of this dilemma are retold again and again by the Czech writers. I will give you an example in a minor key with tragic implications and one in a major key with comic implications. The former, the tragic one, can best be illustrated, although it's funny again, the plays are always humorous. The former can be best illustrated by Ivan Klima's The Jury. There we have a motley group of citizens, a former army captain, a barber, a milkmaid, an engineer, and an archivist. They are cloistered as a jury in order to pronounce judgment on an accused man. And it emerges from their discussion in the beginning of the play that they are convinced this man is innocent. The absurd twist in Klima's play is that the accused, and the jury finds that out in the course of the play, has been executed already, and the jury's verdict will be merely a rubber stamp so that the case can be closed and the files put away. The play consists in those six people's deliberations. They're brilliantly realistic. And they become increasingly sharp as the time pressure for the decision mounts. The central question for the audience changes from, is the accused or was the accused guilty, to, will the jury act as puppets? They do act as puppets, but each has a very good reason and a very human reason. The captain, the army captain, used to obey orders, is quick to label the accused a traitor. After all, he's worked for the establishment for a long time, and they know what they are doing up there, and they must be right. So he must be a traitor. The barber has to go back to his barber shop. He loses his customers. The countrywoman knows that the cows are, what does a cow do? The cows are mooing with pain because they need to be milked. The engineer realizes that the hole is only a show for public consumption, and he says, well, the poor guy is dead anyway, so who cares? I'll sign it guilty and go home. Doesn't help anybody anymore. I'm a pragmatist. So there's only the archivist who says, no, I know this man was not guilty, and he performs the act of moral courage and writes down the verdict or pronounces the verdict, not guilty. Now, you may think that this was already the catch-22, but it hasn't been the catch-22 yet. It's coming. The archivist leaves the building, and he is frightened because he has cast an unpopular vote there or a verdict, and he wants to tiptoe out the back door. Although, despite the fact that he's afraid, he knows at least I've stuck up, I've stuck to the truth. But he's stopped by the public prosecutor who the archivist is frightened and thinks he will lock him up immediately, but the public prosecutor warmly shakes his hand and thanks him for contributing to the good public image of the Department of Justice, namely by voting, by producing one dissenting vote. He showed that the jury was completely independent. In other words, the archivist had helped to preserve the false image of justice and had played an important role in furthering manipulation and injustice. Now, on the lighter side of the scale, I would like to discuss very briefly Pavel Kohout's play, Attest, which he wrote in 1979 when he was still in Czechoslovakia. Since then, he has left and he's now in Vienna. In Attest, a shy, innocuous, you know, those central characters are always sort of shy, innocuous people who get into trouble in a big office, they're always in this situation where they don't understand what's really going on. This is a very typical figure in Czech literature, in the prose as well as in drama. So this shy citizen needs a dog license, because he has acquired a thoroughbred dog. It was somebody had given it to his wife, and he would like to breed it. Now, the shy man happens to be a writer, and he's a dissident writer, one of those who, as I pointed out a while ago, does not exist in theory because the regime considers him a non-person. Now, here's your catch-22. How does a man who has no papers and who doesn't exist get a dog license? The play is a sparkling satire which got rave reviews after its premiere in Vienna in November 1979, just 2 years ago. The play recreates the dusty bureaucratic atmosphere of the pets registration office, which is managed by a formidable lady whose ideological fervor is matched only by her fear of dogs. Though it must be said that the dog whom the writer brings is even more afraid of the lady. The dog plays a part too. So there is an ideological deadlock. She can't give a license to a man who doesn't exist. This deadlock is solved by a young secretary, the daughter of a high party official. She just works in the office for a little while before she gets married to a young party functionary, of course. And she is sorry for this poor man and the dog. And so she phones up Daddy at the Ministry of External Affairs and tells him that she has just bought him this beautiful dog, but because he was too busy running the country and looking after all the good people in the country and taking care of the country's affairs, she also found a man who was going to look after the dog and would even breed it for her father. Now, Daddy doesn't mind, agrees, the problem is solved, the curtain goes down. The audience's amusement, the audience who sees that play, their amusement might be tempered if they knew that Cohout experienced another grimmer version of Catch-22 with his own dog in Prague, and in reality, his dog did not survive. But that is another story. As I gave you these brief insights, you will perhaps have been able to judge for yourselves that Czech writers have a very strong sense of humor and they have preserved it. The plays and the stories and the novels, no matter how serious their concerns, never lose their irony, their sense of fun, their playfulness, their delight in histrionics. Leaders there, the political personalities, have understood this. The only revolt and the only manifestation of dignity against which one cannot do anything is, after all, still laughter. As far as the genre of the theater is concerned, there is a problem. The great plays that were written in the 60s and in the 70s somehow might not continue to be written. I'm noticing, and I'm getting some material in various ways, the writers who wash buses or wash lavatories or work in a mine or are night watchmen, that's what they are doing now, they can go on writing, but they can't very well go on writing plays because you need to go to the theater to write plays. And they haven't been to the theater, they have been to some place, but they haven't seen any of their own plays and they haven't seen any theater for 13 years. Now, Ivan Klima, who wrote Games, that was, as I told you, produced in Vancouver, well, what would he give to see a production of Games? He has never seen it on stage. And what seems to have happened is that writers still in Czechoslovakia who cannot go to the theater begin to write partly poetry and partly prose. Now, it is a pity, in a way, because the histrionic genius of the Czechs is great, just as their musical genius is great. I think it is a pity that the plays perhaps now won't be written for a while, but perhaps it is not so much of a loss, because the prose is surprisingly excellent. And in connection with this, I'd like to mention a unique, I think, fact in contemporary literary history. During the brief span of the last 4 years, five startlingly original big novels have appeared in print. All were written by Czechs in Czech, But they have appeared in German or French or English or in a combination of these three languages. They were all written by authors of more or less the same generation. They're all about 50 years of age now. Two still live in Czechoslovakia, that is Ivan Klíma and Vaculík. One lives in Paris, that's Milan Kundera. One in Vienna, that's Pavel Kohout. And one in Toronto, that's Josef Škvorecký. These five works seem to me to reflect the nature of the Czech genius in a particularly interesting way. All are about man, his language, and his imperfect grasp of justice, his urge to understand his past, and all are funny and tragic at the same time, and reflect the age-old awareness of a people on the crossroads of vast conflicts, that life's farce can be deadly serious, but that the most tragic situation contains somehow a funny proportion. The novels, these five novels, have not yet fully entered the consciousness of our contemporary literary scene. They have not sufficiently been talked about yet or reviewed. But I believe they will. And I think we can all be happy that one of these five novels is a Canadian one. Thank you very much.
Our speaker will be pleased to answer questions, so if you would raise your hand and I'll signal that it's your turn or the next person's turn. Any questions?
Yes, Vera. Yes. I'm asked whether there are any women writers. There are two, yes. There is Kam Turková and Krízeová. They are two very interesting women writers who have, however, not written dramas. There is one who is now, she was in great trouble, and so she began to write children's books and is surviving that way, Alena Vostra, who has written two very good plays. But the other two have written prose. And it is interesting that women writers somehow write prose rather than drama. They excel rather in prose writings. And if you look at literature, perhaps we have more prose, great prose by women than we have dramas. Yeah.
Would it be possible for you to translate some of those Czech plays and have some of the scenes acted out for this audience sometime?
Well, quite a few have been translated, actually. One could set up quite a sort of a potpourri of scenes with perhaps a theme to it. And now when Klíma's Games was put on here last summer, I just didn't know how it would go, and the audience was just delighted, and they packed it full. And the Touchstone players they are very good, but they have often had difficulty in filling the audience here. They had to turn people away. When it had some run. So the people, it is strange that it's very local theater, but also somehow very international, and it makes sense to us. So I'm sure this could be arranged, and some actors, the Touchstone Theater is just delighted with the Czech things, so they might do something like that. if it were initiated.
You mentioned that many of the Czech plays are being printed in Canada.
Yes.
Are they played in Canada in Czech? Do you have Czech audiences that hear them here?
Not that much. Somehow, the one of they are played more often in English. I suppose. And if somebody Czech in the audience wants to correct me, somehow people who have lived under great pressure in Czechoslovakia, when they come out here, they really want to absorb the language, they want to understand the country, they want to, and they become somehow attached then to this country, which is very good to live in, and which still has a, no matter how critical we may be sometimes, which has a great residue of freedom still, so that they somehow, despite the fact that they read a lot and they love their culture, and there is a Czech group who has played Czech plays, but they have played older plays by older classics and not the newest plays. But in English they have been played quite a bit, those plays, particularly Havel, Klima a bit, Kohout. I don't know whether in the East, from what I know, in Toronto they have, I think, done two Czech plays, but I'm not too well informed about it. Yes, Patricia? Sorry. It's all right. Patricia will after. Yeah.
Your remarks about language are very interesting. 50 years ago, last time I was in the other side of the Iron Curtain, the Soviets were having a flirtation with Esperanto.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that flirtation has become a marriage, or whether they've given up all hope of trying to persuade some of their states to acquire this?
Not in Czechoslovakia, not as far as I know in Poland. Somehow in Eastern Europe it's, you see, I'm using myself the term, because somehow you are not understand if you say Middle Europe. One thinks of 600 miles further west. In the schools, people learn, they are obliged to learn Russian, and then they also learn French, and they learn a lot of English now. I don't think I didn't hear anything about Esperanto when I was there. So does anybody know here?
Yes. Radio station in Poland, they have quite a magazine. Well, actually, Esperanto originated in Poland 100 years ago. And I have an uncle in Bohemia who corresponded with people in about 100 countries. And I think he knows more about the world thanks to the Esperanto. And because probably censors, I don't think are so verbal in Esperanto as maybe they are in English, in German. Probably he gets better information about the world through Esperanto than he, you know, maybe than otherwise, in other languages. So Esperanto is alive in his view.
It's very interesting, but it is alive, I think, in the opposite sense, if so. I did not know that. In the opposite sense of what you meant, it is alive rather for an individual who communicates privately on his own and is used perhaps in an unofficial way, much more so, perhaps in the opposite sense of what you had asked.
People feel that they can learn faster, which is true. You can learn faster the basic Esperanto than another live language. So it's a faster way to get also then magazines or some other literature, which there are books printed in Esperanto.
And oh, yes.
I believe by last statistics, there must be about 5 million people today in the world who speak Esperanto.
Yeah, well, it remains, however, I suppose, a network only for the initiated. It somehow has not broken through as an actual communication. It's a network of individuals, I would say, rather, I suppose. Yeah. Pat?
I noticed some affinities, particularly with the plays of Ionesco. I mean, Rhinoceros, perhaps, or the lesson in some of those plays you gave us excerpts from. And I wondered if this was perhaps in part because Ionesco shared a Middle European sensibility.
Huh?
Some sense of a Middle European political situation, or because the Czech playwrights honored Ionesco as being some part of the appropriate European dramatic heritage for them, or some combination of the two.
I think your former point, I think Ionesco has this, Ionesco is Romanian by birth, and has, I think, the Middle European consciousness. The encounter of the Czechs with Ionesco is very interesting because they were extremely excited when they began to play him by 1960, and they particularly played the Rhinoceros, also the bald soprano. And they were. It's interesting that the first performance of Ionesco in Prague was actually after Havel had written his first play about language. So it's interesting. There is not really direct influence, but somehow they picked up the same static in the air, which,
The amateur theaters in Czechoslovakia, are they under direct government supervision, or can the amateur theater group put on whatever they would like?
They couldn't put on any of these playwrights, not at all. I mean, Havel's Beggar's Opera was put on by an amateur group, and they all paid very badly for it by losing their job. And so they couldn't put on what they want, but they would be careful not to get into trouble. And they could put on; they would have to let the local person in the town or in the village, in the culture, know what they are playing, but they are otherwise pretty free. But excluding these playwrights, absolutely. No, they could not touch them. Yeah, yeah, Jim? What do they play? Yeah. Well, yes, that's very interesting. Well, they play classics, but they play the classics. They play a lot of Shakespeare. They don't play Macbeth. You see, Macbeth is much too political. You can't have something about power. They don't play the history plays. They play Shakespeare. They play Ibsen. They play. Some American playwrights of the 20s, they play Czech classics picked out, not everything. They play boulevard comedies, French plays. They play Chekhov, although Chekhov becomes also very hot property because Chekhov, I mean, they sit there and they drink tea in a Russian samovar, so far so good. But then what do they do, the Chekhov characters? They talk about what life is all about, and that's one isn't supposed to do that. Because if you march toward a glorious future, so that the Chekhov, there have been some magnificent performances of Chekhov. The Three Sisters, Uncle Vanya, I have seen a couple myself. But so Chekhov is played also within reason. Then what is played are operas, operettas, and then there are also quite a few quite talented light writers who write sort of boulevard comedies and farces and light things which are performed, contemporary ones. So it's a variety. I saw a play by Zuckmayer, the German writer by Zuckmayer, now in August, who wrote It is the Hauptmann von Köpenick. Some of you may know it. And it is a satire against Wilhelminian militarism. And so it is, in a way, safe as a play, as a topic. But of course, it was played. It became extremely political, and the audience went just wild. And in between, they had sort of guards. When in the intermission, they had two guards who came off the stage and stood there and just watched the audience. Oh. And people were coming in with not popcorn, but whatever, they don't eat popcorn there, but whatever they had. And one of them would pull out a little notebook and take a look and make a note in his notebook, put it away. And the audience just understood completely. And this was a play that was meant to be Wilhelminian Germany, but it was the audience just transfers it to themselves. But so they play. Yeah, Sheila. Well, yes, sorry. Whether there's a chance for the writers to have an intellectual contact with each other. Well, they meet, they work. If they have jobs, they have very hard jobs, and they very often have jobs as night watchmen, that they have to sleep during the day and so. Night watchmen somehow is very popular. They say you can read a little bit on the job, so it's not the worst. But they have a narrow circle of friends whom they trust and with whom they meet and with whom they talk. So there is a narrow circle, but at the moment the situation is not good at all, so that larger groups never meet, maybe two or three, no more than that.
Do you think that the general theater going public is aware of this body of plays that they're?
Yeah, you see, this is the 20-year-old young man, you know, who hasn't seen any of these plays anymore, because when they stopped playing them, he was 7. Well, this man would know of their existence, and I think he would have read them in the Petlice in some kind of a form, reproduced form, or they were also published then, so he could still read them. The average, but they are very much aware that these plays were played in the 60s, and I think the memories are very strong of these plays in the 60s, and they are aware of them. How aware of them, of the ones that were written after 1969, only occasional people will be aware, because somehow what circulates is perhaps more the prose. It is very difficult to measure the circulation, how many people really literally get a hold of the book and read it. A few hundred, surely, maybe 1,000, maybe more than 1,000, but it is very limited. But they are aware of the contemporary local literature in the 60s, I would say.
In Kafka's day, German was the first popular language. What's happened to the popularity of German since the eyes of direction?
Well, it's funny with German because, when Kafka, during the 20s, there was a German population in Prague smaller than the Czech one, so it wasn't it was perhaps, I would say, no more than perhaps 15-20%. But of course, German took over very much between 39 and 45, took over forcibly, with the result that in 1945 no German was spoken at all. And it wasn't spoken, and people, the young people did not learn German, and the older people who knew German didn't speak it. And until then something funny happened, perhaps in the by the 60s or the late 50s, somehow German became the perhaps slightly exaggerating, but not too much, the Esperanto of these countries, because somehow people knew German, and they didn't know a Hungarian and a Slovak. If they had a bit of German, they communicated in German, and more than French, I would say. So that somehow German has filtered in again via tourism. And now, if you go in Prague, there are so many German tourists from the east and from the west, from eastern and western Germany, and they can manage quite well in the country with German. It's a complex emotional situation, which perhaps the younger generation is not that aware of anymore, but the older is. Yeah.
Is there a chance that the repressive or the repression of literature is a self-defeating plan, in that when you deny things to people, they often want them? Can it be that this literature, having to be passed from hand to hand, it's a wider circulation than it would otherwise?
Quite possibly. The question is that this suppression of the literature might make people want it more, and that the literature, if it circulates from hand to hand, might get a wider circulation than as if it were printed. People, this was the question. Yes, I don't know whether it would get a wider circulation, because just the very physical difficulty of writing, of typing out a 500-page manuscript, you know, is and making five copies, and the fifth you can hardly read. This is a very difficult situation. So I don't think it has a wider circulation, but it has a tremendous component of excitement, and people sit up all night and they read such a book because they know they have to hand it on, and they pass like hidden treasures they pass around. And it is quite true. If you tell people you do some reading, they won't read. But if you tell them, don't you read anything, they want to read. This is looking at the funny side of it. But people are very thirsty for literature. And even when a new book is published, they line up. They line up, you know, they have to line up for everything, as you know, but they also line up for books. If there's a certain publishing date, you will see a lineup, and the book is sometimes sold out within 5 days of its appearance.
Perhaps one last question.
Yes, Dr. Crane.
One of the most famous actors in Czechoslovakia already when I was living there, was where would you like to make comment to Ida? He is still probably very strongly in the mind of many Czechs.
I think he is very strongly in the mind of many of the writers. And the writers also say they have learned an enormous amount from Verich. He could improvise. It was a team with Voskovets. Voskovets spent his in the end about 12 years in New York, whereas Verich stayed in Czechoslovakia. And he was, I think, probably he taught the people the particular brand of humor. He taught it to them perhaps not so much in prose, but on the stage. And he taught them how to communicate with an audience and speak to an audience and draw from the audience their response and then respond to the audience. Respond to the audience from the stage. I think there is a big book to be written on the influence of the tremendous influence of Werich, of Voskovec and Werich on Middle Europe as a whole, and particularly on the Czech writers. Oh, yes. Yes.
Professor Ira Nadal of the Department of English will thank our speaker.
What I want to say as a preface, I'm going to talk in old speak, not in new speak, first of all. I think tonight that you have really achieved a very difficult task, and that is informing us about a culture and a theater in another country and in another language. And we are all grateful for your ability to convey something of the meaning of freedom in art, which I think we in the West have perhaps taken too easily for granted. From your talk tonight, I think we understand more clearly what this year's Nobel laureate in literature, Czesław Miłosz, meant when he wrote these words, "The voice of passion is better than the voice of reason. The passionless cannot change history." Certainly, theater and literature in Czechoslovakia possess the passion that can change history, as you have made so clear this evening, providing, I think, the Prague spring with a complete season. On behalf of the Institute, let me say thank you for taking us through the streets of Czechoslovakian culture and theater and providing us with such a stimulating and invigorating talk tonight. Thank you.
I learned so much from you.
Yeah, oh, that's lovely. Well, one can do so little in an hour. I always worry, what can you... Yeah.